This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The Lake Gang, the Ghost Town Gang, Los Town Freaks, Los Cocos. These are just a few names of San Antonio gangs that, in a manner, controlled streets and alleys of local neighborhoods. Why did these gangs form? Who joined them and why? How did local gangs impact the city, local crime, even local politics? Chicano gangs have been part of the city for over a century. Why do they endure and how have they changed? We're talking about 100 years of barrio gangs in San Antonio with Mike Tapia. He's a professor of criminal justice at New Mexico State University and author of The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio from 1915 to 2015. We invite you into our conversation. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can tweet us at @tprsource. And Mike, welcome back to The Source.
Dave, thanks for having me on again.
I know we talked before as you were working on the book, and now here a couple of years later, it is now complete. And let me ask you, how did you get into this? What was the start of this?
Yeah, I mean, I got into the whole gang arena in San Antonio as a young man, just graduated from St. Mary's University and needed a job, got a job as a social worker doing gang intervention in a neighborhood called Indian Creek, a rather notorious southwestern neighborhood in San Antonio. And I mean, you know, that was basically it. It just kind of charted the course for understanding these groups, you know, their all of their nuances, their hierarchies. You know, it just opened up this whole new world to me back in the late 90s.
So there is a structure to the gangs, and I've heard comparisons, or I don't know if it's if it's made up or not, mythological, but to say it's mirrors or copies the cacique system of the Aztecs.
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, there is a lot of like mythology and symbolism, in the philosophy of especially the prison gangs, right? You know, I mean, they have this strict code and a real deep belief system that, you know, they're kind of the downtrodden of society, and you know, and they're using this spiritualism, you know, as, you know, some kind of right to rebel, essentially.
So let's make sure that we don't get too rosy and nostalgic about the gangs. So a lot of these gangs were very violent.
Yeah, that's one kind of misconception about when you think about kind of the early versions, you know, the 1930s, 40s, 50s gangs, right? You know, people think, oh, you know, that's the idyllic, you know, 50s, you know, Bobby Sox and, drive-in theaters.
Happy days.
Yeah, exactly. All that imagery. But, man, you know, it was actually probably as violent. You know, whether you study, like, actual, you know, violent crime statistics or just study the subculture in a qualitative way that I've done, oh man, it was every bit as intense, as violent. It just, the way it manifested was slightly different because, you know, kind of the tools of the trade that we have today were not there. You know, there was a lot of up close and personal confrontations and
rumbles, you know, that were pretty violent.
Rumbles, you know, and even though it was like, you know, chains and daggers and, you know, switchblades and stuff like that, and makeshift guns and stuff.
Zip guns.
Zip guns, exactly. You know, but so my, the guys I interviewed, the senior citizens that were kind of my primary interviewees, right, research subjects, you know, they made it clear. They wanted me to be, you know, clear on that point that, you know, they had more guts, I guess you could say, than modern day Chicano gang members.
Because they didn't just drive by a house and unload a bunch of bullets. They were doing it up close and personal. They thought that was a point of pride.
Right, right. That's what they wanted to convey, and it came through pretty clear.
Our phone lines are open. We'd like to hear your stories, if you are connected to the gangs back in the day. And that makes the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. That may strike people as kind of odd. We solicit folks to call in and say if you were a gang member back in the day. But, Mike, it seems like there were a lot of people who may have been on the periphery or even deep into the gang life when they were kids. But as they grew up and matured, they went on and became complete professionals.
Precisely. You know, gangs, we tend to think of gangs as a kind of this separate underworld, you know, this very mysterious and nebulous, you know, kind of thing that occurs, you know, underneath the surface of conventional society. But no, on the contrary, it's like everybody, you know, especially in a kind of working class, you know, Mexican American town like San Antonio, it's like you really don't have to look far to find that, you know, kind of average folks have some connection, whether it was a tío or a primo or, you know, or just a friend, you know, in school, especially South and West Side. You know, they can totally relate. And right, they may have been on the periphery of that sort of activity themselves, and then some event in their life, some turning point, as we call it in criminology, you know, just kind of guided them in a different direction.
So we can, what's the percentage of people who are involved in youth gangs who actually go on to becoming career criminals?
It's a pretty low percentage, right? You know, just generally speaking, you know, all of your in a cohort of, you know, arrestees, for example, you know, in any given year, it's pretty consistent that 6%, 6-8% will stay in a life of crime, you know, become, you know, into their later years and stuff. But most people age out, or, you know, some event happens in their life that takes them out of it.
So when you say become a career criminal, that means possibly getting connected with one of the prison gang systems that we have, like the Mexican Mafia, Texas Syndicate, something like that?
Correct, yeah. Or you know, if you, like some of the guys in my study, if you predate those structures, you know, because prison gangs in San Antonio really didn't get going until the early 80s. So there are guys, you know, who kind of predate that and never really bought into, you know, the whole structure and methods that prison gangs used, and just kind of stayed in business, you know, in that sort of, you know, lifestyle themselves as independent, either drug dealers or just, you know, kind of, you know, involved in other types of crime throughout their life.
Like petty burglary and things like that? Or
yeah, or they, you know, they passed it on, you know, as well, you know, kind of to their next of kin and stuff.
Sure. I got a friend who can get me that cheap. So yeah, that type of deal.
Right.
And so I want to talk about some of the big gang people in San Antonio's past. I don't want to start now because we're going to need some time to talk about people like Fred Gomez Carrasco and tell his story. And he was legendary in San Antonio and may have changed gang life quite a bit here in the town, and how narcotics was moved through the city. I also want to ask you about who Black Diamond was and his story and why he was a part of San Antonio lore. And how gangs are really, you know, and they have their own folklore. And these stories they pass to each other, these are very important to them. And they seem to pay a lot of attention to the stories of the big gang members of the past that may be maybe 50, 60 years ago. So we're going to talk about this when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open. We're talking about 100 years of Chicano gangs in San Antonio. What are our misconceptions about these gangs, and what do we got right? We're going to continue this conversation when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Look at San Antonio. Look across the entirety of San Antonio. It's a working-class town. It's not a high-income town. It's a town of a majority of Mexican-Americans. This is a town that has a long history with Chicano street gangs, and this city is also seen as a hub or a capital for Chicano street gangs across the country. Where do these gangs come from? What is their heritage? What do they value? How do they recruit? How do they retain their members? What impact does it have on the local economy? It does have an impact on that, and even local politics. We're joined by Michael Tapia. He's a professor of criminal justice at New Mexico State University. He's the author of The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio. And let me get in a caller. This is Wakanda. And Wakanda, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Are you talking about Winnetka?
Yeah, Winnetka. That's you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, I'm a 12th generation Tejana, but I lived in the Near West Side in the late 60s, early 70s before I left for Chicago to go to school. But I was wondering, what is the exact percentage of these gang members compared to the total Mexican-American population? And also, my second question would be, how does it explain the phenomenon of the parochial, the Catholic parochial school, which were scattered all over the West Side and the Southwest Side, and what is the societal results of those people compared to the people in the gangs?
All right, Winnetka, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So, Mike, what was the population like?
It was 10%. You know, I can answer that straight away because that was one of the, social science tests that, you know, that I ran for this research project. You know, that was actually a starting point. I wanted to know, you know, what is the extent of this type of activity over time? You know, what portion of the general Mexican-American youth population does this draw in? And does that change over time, right? So I had police data for current years, right? And so that was an easy, you know, equation to set up. You know, the gang unit here at SAPD, because I was at UTSA for quite a while, I interacted with them and got a lot of data from them. And, you just take, you know, kind of like the overall number of people in their database and, you know, set it to, you know, the larger population of boys primarily in those age groups, right? Talking about youth gangs, roughly like ages 13 to 21 is probably a good cutoff. And it came in at about, you know, like 9.something%. And then, you know, so when I went back in time and did that kind of math for the 50s, even though census data didn't exist, I didn't have the exact data, I was still able to simulate. And it came in at a startlingly similar percentage. It was right about, you know, 8.5 or, you know, right around the same percentage. So if you count kind of peripheral people as well, who don't ever make it onto the police radar, yeah, you're talking about roughly 10% of the Mexican-American youth population. And those are 60 years apart, those two estimates. So that's a remarkable similarity. So I think it's pretty reliable.
Does that mean anything, that number 10% may have held through all those generations?
There was probably a little bit of fluctuation because the early 90s was really the height of it. So I think it probably was a bit inflated. There are people that I cite in the book, whose work I cite in the book, were mostly journalists, but they were, you know, talking about how the gang craze that swept across the country just attracted a lot of what we might otherwise call good kids, you know, athletes and stuff, who were just fascinated with guns and violence and, you know, just kind of got, just swept up into that because it was almost like a fad, right? But I think, you know, just over time, yeah, I think that 10%, it's very telling of, like, you know, what portion. We might refer to these, some theorists call this the underclass, right? These are mostly the folks that live in the projects or other low-income neighborhoods, you know, where there's really not much recreation or, you know, they're just not involved in other extracurricular activities. So they turn to gangs as a natural, it's just a natural outgrowth of, you know, kind of youth culture when there's not much else left for them to do.
Another caller, Barbara, is on the line. Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I was calling because my father, he's now passed, but he was born in 1945 here in San Antonio. He grew up in the Apache courts, and he was in a gang called La India. And I always heard about it growing up. And I think he was in it from the time he was 12 years old and ran around with him through high school. My grandmother couldn't keep him out of trouble. She tried. She would send him off to relatives. But he said the only thing that saved him was being drafted during Vietnam. And his friends that were, like, younger and didn't get drafted, most of them are dead now, were in jail, were on drugs. But I remember years later, when I was in high school, so this would have been, like, 30 years ago, he came to San Antonio, and we went driving through his old neighborhood, and he recognized a man on a street corner, the same street corner that they used to hang out off on Commerce Street. And he said, if it wasn't for Vietnam, that's where I would be. And I am the first generation on both sides of my family not to grow up in the courts and, you know, have a successful life. And he said, that would have been me. And so that's my story. I mean, Vietnam didn't do them any favors in many ways, but it kept him out of prison, he says.
Barbara, thank you so much for the call. Very informative. Mike, you're nodding your head. This is something that resonates?
Completely. I think Barbara's dad's experience is very typical. That's something that I capture in the book is, you know, a lot of these guys, the way they made it, you know, out of the gangs, and oftentimes it was the juvenile bureau detectives themselves who, you know, would give them this ultimatum. Right. And say, look, you know, you're a shot caller. You know, you've been in trouble with me, you know, several times before. You're a natural leader here in the barrio. Set an example for you guys, man. You know, do something productive with your life. You're obviously, you know, got a lot of smarts and guts and everything. How about the military? And the ultimatum essentially was, you know, we can either go down to the station and process you, you know, for intake, and possibly the judge will send you to Gatesville School for Boys, or we can go down to the recruiter's office, you know. And at that time, you know, there was like in the 50s and stuff, probably even 60s, you know, regulations, you know, for having a criminal background, you know, to go into the military were not what they are today. So it saved a lot of guys, at least temporarily, because there was no guarantee that they wouldn't come back, as she, you know, kind
of. Yeah, the fatalities, incredible.
Yeah, that they wouldn't, or even if they made it back, right, you know, after Nam or whatever, you know, there's no guarantee that they wouldn't fall back into the lifestyle, right?
But going into the military taught a lot, self-discipline, pride, and gave them resources to, the GI Bill to get out.
Totally. Yeah. So, you know, it did save a lot of guys. And it's a very recurrent story in the guys that I interviewed. You know, a lot of them did go into the military. Some of them still went, you know, did stints in prison after that. But, you know, it gave them some certain type of, you know, character and fortitude and stuff like that. Just quickly, the gang that she was referencing that her dad belonged to. Yeah, La India was, you know, one of the extremely well-known West Side gangs. And they, like she said, they were along Commerce. But they're essentially around Colorado and Salina Street was kind of, you know, part of their turf, right next to a group called El Jalisco.
Okay. Brandy has called in. Brandy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to give my perspective on gang culture here in San Antonio. I'm fourth generation San Antonian, and my mom's side of the family grew up on the west side. And obviously, you know, being a part of gang culture was not something that my grandma or my mom wanted for me and my sister. But my understanding of it, you know, after hearing a lot of their stories with encounters with gangs on the west side, it was primarily more of a territorial thing that whenever they saw gangs, it was primarily dealing with territory. Like whenever some new kids or new family would come into the neighborhood, sometimes, you know, there would be a run-in, and all this was, you know, basically like hand-to-hand combat. It wasn't drive-by shootings back then in the 70s. And when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, like I said, they wanted to make sure that I was not a part of that. So the message was pretty clear. If you minded who your friends were, and if you stayed out of the gang's lane, then you could, you know, basically get away out of the neighborhood unharmed. And that was just my perspective. I know it was very different for other people, but it seemed to have worked pretty well for me and my sister. We ended up, you know, graduating from high school, graduating from college, and ended up being pretty successful later on in life and not repeating that pattern that my mom so often saw on the west side. So just wanted to put that out there.
Thank you, Brandy. Appreciate that. So was that part of the code of the gangs? If you were a civilian, if you weren't a player, then you could get by where you weren't going to be victimized?
For sure. Yeah. You know, and that's the case today. You know, I mean, random acts of violence do happen. You know, people get carjacked and stuff like that. But by and large, I mean, those are in such the minority, you know, that's just kind of bad luck, you know, desperation on one person's part, you know, meets opportunity. But I want to hit on a theme, you know, that Brandy raises, which is extremely important. You know, thinking about how gangs change over time, barrio gangs, right? The word gang and barrio, you know, in and of themselves, you know, just looking at the way, you know, what those meant over time is really important, an important lesson here. You know, she talks about turf, for example, right? And so barrio, like the word gang really wasn't in vogue, and it really wasn't, you know, in the vocabulary of a lot of our 1940s and 50s, what we might call, you know, barrio gangs or whatever. You know, they used the word barrio. Barrio is a synonym, you know, today for gang, right? You know, you see all these East LA movies and, you know, que barrio and, you know, all this stuff, right? It's just a refrain that you hear in that subculture. But yeah, it was about turf, you know, it was about, you know, kind of micro locality, you know, what were these boundaries and did you live inside those boundaries? And if you were a street oriented or streetwise kid, you know, you just gravitated towards the, you know, other boys and girls that were, you know, also shared that perspective, right? That's one central theme in the book, you know, thinking about 100 years of history, that's a burning question is like, is that still the same? You know, do things still operate by that sort of code, and do neighborhood boundaries mean that much? And so the answer is yes and no, right? It just kind of depends on who you ask. I'd ask like gang detectives, you know, say like Bexar County Juvenile Gang Unit, you know, and one guy that I cite in the book, you know, says, oh yeah. Yeah, in this day and age, for sure, if those gang boundaries are still there, and if kids from a rival gang cross turf, they're bound to get jumped or shot or whatever. So there are some things that, you know, are pretty constant in this subculture.
Yeah, you can go on YouTube and you can search under San Antonio gangs, and you'll see how violent they still are. They make videos of it and they post it online, and you can see what the fights are. But even as we have still the local gangs, and they named themselves after their local area, like the Lake Gang was around Elmendorf Lake and those types of areas. And the Ghost Town Gang is also. But there's also transnational gangs where we have, there may be hyper-local, but also international.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, now you're talking about a modern, you know, manifestation of this phenomenon, right? You know, it has grown insidious in nature, you know, very, very sinister. You know, there's a lot of money behind it. You
ruthless.
Know, totally. And you know, it's grown into an industry of sorts wherever, you know, connections between, you know, Mexican drug cartels and, you know, some of the more sophisticated groups in our American cities exist. And they do. And, you know, probably that you know, it might be overplayed, you know, like, you know, there's a lot of public, you know, kind of alarm about the extent to which those actually exist. But they're definitely there. And you know, and just as the later chapters of the book, you know, talk about the advent of prison gangs and stuff like that, things definitely took a turn towards a more serious, dangerous, and violent direction.
Okay, we're going to continue our conversation into the second half hour of The Source. We will get to Fred Gomez Carrasco. We will find out who Black Diamond was. And we're going to take more of your calls. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980, talking about 100 years of barrio gangs in San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me, Mike Tapia, he is the professor of criminal justice at New Mexico State University, author of The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio, 1915 to 2015. Our phone lines are open. We're getting a lot of calls. 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. So I want to get on Fred Gomez Carrasco. When I was a kid growing up in San Antonio in like the 60s and 70s, we would run around the streets. I grew up around Zarzamora and that area. We were little kids. We would play Fred Gomez Carrasco. That was the game. That game that we'd play in the streets. You know, we'd see the stories about him on TV every night. You turn on 12 Star Final. You hear about the latest episode of how he outsmarted the cops. He did this. He did that. He was kind of a Robin Hood figure, a Jesse James of San Antonio, who was just always one step ahead. And revolutionized narco trafficking. Is that?
Oh, man. Completely. Fred Gomez Carrasco is the quintessential, you know, kind of local just like figure of all that, you know, sort of outlaw bandido. And you know, he's a barrio boy. You know, he grew up over here in what would be it was called Garfield Alley at the time. But and I think that alley, actually that street name is still there. But over by the Victoria Courts. You know, so he would have been kind of in that part of, you know, southeastern downtown. But, yeah, Fred was just this, you know, just this almost like mythical, you know, figure.
He's like the ultimate ladies man. He was ran the streets. Nothing happened in San Antonio without his approval.
He was
much money. And
he was a barrio boy turned don. He was like the first, you know, real what they used to call them ruedas, you know, but he was the biggest rueda, baller, you know, he was it. And he had a drug operation. He charted so much territory. And, you know, it's not to glorify him, but I mean, it's just that, you know, he was a pioneer, you know, and I think I make the argument that he laid the foundation for a lot of the stuff we see today. But you're right. A lot of kids, and not just kids. I mean, you know, they sung ballads about him, corridos. I mean, he was just a local folk hero. You know, even though it was for all the wrong reasons, but that's, you know, that's part of our culture too. You know, we celebrate that kind of, you know, rebellion and, you know, kind of antisocial, you know, sort of existence sometimes.
Sure. And he had that massive shootout trying to get out of the prison walls unit in Huntsville, which went on for days and days and days. And then it was stuff of legend as well. So even after he was captured with the massive shootout, and then when he was in Bexar County Jail, he was accused of still running the operation and running the jail itself from inside. And then when he was finally put into Huntsville, he was still, you know, he couldn't be kept down. It was just a story that just kept growing.
Yeah, Fred, you know, had that kind of influence, that kind of charisma. And, you know, just age-wise, his is the generation that I studied. You know, in other words, a lot of the guys that I interviewed for this were, you know, they knew Fred, you know, intimately. I mean, they were, you know, they were buddies growing up. And so, yeah, he would have been, Fred would be about, you know, in his early 80s, you know, right now, if he had lived. And so a lot of guys that, you know, I interviewed did time with him. And, you know, they knew what he was like on the streets and out here. And so he was made. Also, he was kind of immortalized in a book, right? You know, that came in the mid-70s called The Heroin Merchant, you know, Fred Gomez Carrasco. And, you know, it was a journalist, a newspaper journalist here out of the Express News. And, you know, he just pretty much kind of chronicled what was going on in Fred's. It was a snapshot in time. You know, there was so much going on with him. But I take it to the next, you know, level, because, you know, mine is more of a history. There was yes, a legacy before and after Fred. You know, Fred just didn't pop out of nowhere, right? You know, there was a context that created a San Antonio Vidro context that it allowed such a character to emerge, right? A streetwise, you know, very savvy,
ambitious,
you know, ambitious individual, you know, who saw a lot of other, probably learned from a lot of other people's mistakes, probably had a really high IQ, you know, probably.
Right. Wasted, you know, potential.
Yeah.
If he had been given a different route, you know, who knows what he could have achieved.
Right, exactly. And that's true of so many, you know, Vidro figures, you know, gang members and stuff. They are, a lot of them do tend to be very sharp, charismatic people who just, you know, don't fit into conventional institutions in society, right?
So I went to the San Antonio Library and requested the file, the Fred Gomez Carrasco file of all the newspaper clippings. And they say that's the most requested file. People ask for that file all the time to read about what actually happened.
Of course, right? And so it's even hard to find, you know, the book that Wilson McKinney wrote. I mean, if you try to order it, it's going to be in the hundreds of dollars, right? So I have a copy that I had to photocopy, you know, from an obscure library that I found. But, right, you know, so, yeah, and that's the stuff of, you know, that just creates a lot of this urban legends and stuff that is part of the Vater.
Who is Black Diamond?
Black Diamond, you know, he didn't achieve that level of notoriety, but, you know, he was somebody whose name is just synonymous with, you know, kind of a West Side Vario charismatic people, right? He was a gang leader for Ghost Town. He died at age 18. The rival gang from the Lake Gang shot him, you know, found him and shot him at close range. And, you know, from what I gather, it wasn't, you know, any debt or, you know, anything. It was probably envidia. You know, it was a lot of jealousy. The guy was known as a flashy dresser, a good dancer, a real ladies man. But yeah, he was a gang leader as well. And his younger brother, Rudy Galan, this was Adolfo Galan. And so the Galan family is still around. They helped tremendously with this project and gave me old photos and stuff like that. And so Rudy carried a big chip on his shoulder about his brother's death his whole life. And so he created a really notorious reputation for himself here in San Antonio's West Side. Ghost town guy, yeah.
So how important are these stories? Are these stories a currency in the gang culture?
I think so. They really carry on. You know, even they're young kids that still, you know, kind of recount their own versions of these things, you know. And that's how I kind of, that was my, you know, sort of impetus is like when I was dealing with the gang members in that intervention project, I'd meet a lot of the elders, you know, and I'd hear about the infamous, you know, gangs called La Dat, the Circle, you know, Ghost Town, Los Cocos, you know, all these legendary gangs, you know, in the poor and working classes. And I said, man, somebody's got to write about this before we lose this history.
And these are the stories that are told around the ice houses of San Antonio.
Totally. Yeah. They'll never die.
All right. Let's go back to the calls. Noe is on the line. Noe, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking my question. I grew up during the 90s, primarily in the south side of town. So, but I noticed, you said earlier, that it was almost like a fad. Every other week you had a new gang popping up here and there. But I was wondering, did Hollywood maybe have anything to do with that? I mean, back in, you know, in 88, you had Colors, the movie that came out. You have Blood In, Blood Out shortly after that, Boys in the Hood, Goodfellas. They all came around right around, like, you know, they were all like one or two years apart, and it kind of seemed like they kind of glorified that lifestyle. Do you think that had anything to do with the rising of, you know, these gangs that were popping up every other week and, you know, during the 90s?
All right, Noe, thank you for the call. So the impact of media on gang culture?
Completely. Right. That's totally undeniable. And it just caught on like wildfire. You know, there was just something about that era and probably weapons availability and drugs availability. And it was
the crack
just
epidemic.
Yeah. It was a perfect storm that came together. You know, you had a lot of what we today call disconnected youth, you know, kids that are just, you know, dropping out of school, not working, just in that perfect kind of sweet spot to get, you know, idle hands and just getting into trouble. And it was very appealing. Right. And ask any gang cop, right, across the country, what the influence of Colors was in particular, or Blood In, Blood Out, or any of these, you know, kind of iconic, you know, Chicano gang films. And as in Colors, you know, Bloods and Crips, right? You know, that caught on as well in every major city. So, yeah, totally. And it led to a dramatic spike in drive-bys and gang violence in early 90s. That lasted all the way through the, like, mid and late 90s, actually.
Yvette's on the line. Yvette, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to make a comment, something trivial, but I grew up in El Paso in the 80s. I was in high school, and I never would have thought to be in a gang, but I just, in high school, I really was fascinated with the connection these groups had, and they were not real gangs. They were just wannabe gangs, but just being part of a group and having that membership, a label, a sense of belonging, was something that I really wanted, and I tried to join a gang, but I wasn't tough enough. But I longed for that, and it was for all the reasons that I think a lot of us want to be part of something. Unfortunately, you know, those that do get really involved and go into the bad habits end up, you know, not really benefiting from that membership. But I can understand the reasoning behind it. And here in San Antonio, I'm an educator, and I see these young kids who act and behave like maybe family members they see, and they're just really also trying to be part of something. Finding a connection is really all that we want.
Yvette, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And so that's something that works. That's the glue?
I think so, for a lot of kids. You know, there are a lot of good kids that get drawn, you know, to gangs. And then, you know, folks are left scratching their heads saying, man, this kid, you know, seemed pretty well integrated, had a good family life and stuff like that. But, right, you know, there's all this, you know, sort of the story about, you know, belonging, you know, to the gang, and it serving as a surrogate family is, you know, a very popular, you know, version.
Overplayed?
I think it's overplayed because it does run in families. You know, it's something you pick up. It's a tradition also from, you know, older persons that were involved.
Okay, we're going to come back from one more break. The number is 210-614-8980. Talking with Mike Tapia about his book, The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio, 100 Years, 1915 to 2015. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Lots of gangs in the history of San Antonio, the Lake Gang, Ghost Town Gang, Los Cocos. Those are just a few of them. They pretty much ran the streets and the alleys of their local neighborhoods. Why do these gangs form? Who joined them and why? How do these gangs impact the city, even local politics? So these gangs have been part of the city for over a century. Why do they endure? How have they changed? We're talking about 100 years of barrio gangs in San Antonio with Mike Tapia, professor of criminal justice at New Mexico State University. His new book, The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio, 1915 to 2015. And Mike, you say one group that is snapping up your book is law enforcement?
Yeah, there's a, there just happens to be the annual conference of the Texas Gang Investigators Association down at the Omni. And so, you know, they're coming from all corners of the state, you know, comparing notes, talking about the latest intelligence and tactics in combating gangs and all this. But, you know, I registered as a vendor. The timing was pretty great. I figured, how can you go wrong? A gang about a book about San Antonio gangs and a gang conference here. So
San Antonio has seen a sharp rise in the number of homicides last year. What's happening with gangs right now?
You know, it's really hard to keep a pulse on that. You know, East Side has always been, you know, just a hotbed. You know, if things will calm down in different parts of town, which they have, you know, the 90s, as others have pointed out, were, you know, just unparalleled. We'll probably, hopefully, never reach those levels. So things are relatively calm, even in the Vadrio. But San Antonio's East Side is just, you know, incessant. You know, that's what, you know, just getting in talks with some of these gang officers over there. You know, it's almost always about the East Side.
We're seeing some neighborhoods getting redeveloped, new money, new businesses moving into old neighborhoods that have not seen this type before. Some people say that's pushing older gangs into other people's territory, and that might be causing this violence.
Right. That's one of the anecdotes that I heard yesterday. One San Antonio gang investigator talked about the demolishing of the East Side projects, right? And that scattered, you know, a lot of that you know, population, you know, into different areas. And now there's a new vying for turf. And, you know, it just, it disorganizes, you know, things that were, you know, somewhat turf-oriented and stuff like the Wheatleys is what I was referring to. Yeah, they got demolished, a couple years ago, and that's just created all kinds of chaos on the East Side. Same phenomena that you see in Chicago. you know, Cabrini Green gets demolished, and then all these gang-involved folks scatter throughout the city, and it just creates all kinds of a big mess there.
You said that some of these gang members have gotten involved in politics. How does that happen?
Well, that's that's probably, you know, one of my colleagues is more well versed in that. A San Antonio guy, you know, grew up over in the Mirasol courts. David Montejano, right? He wrote about Carrasco as well, but he also wrote about the history of the Barrios. And you know, his main argument is like that the gangs were predecessors to the Chicano movement here. You know, so we have a pretty unique history there, and I find it to be true. You know, you see a lot of groups like Brown Berets and stuff,
right.
A lot of former gangsters. So they grew a political conscience in the Chicano eras of the Chicano movement, and it sort of supplanted.
Gave them something to fight for.
Yeah, gave them something legitimate to fight for. And
and the Brown Berets were part of the civil rights movement. They provided security at many of the events.
Right. They're just, you know, kind of parallel to the Black Panthers, you know,
yeah.
Our own version.
Okay, a lot of calls. Bill, hey, Bill, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two quick comments. I came here in the Air Force in 1972. The first night I stayed in San Antonio, I was in a little motel on the southeast side, the Crochelle Motel, flipped the news on at 10 o'clock, and there was this incredible gunfight between the police and one East Fred Gomez Carrasco. So it was horrific to a kid from rural Arkansas to see this. And so I've never had any kind of, and I don't mean this in a mean way at all, any kind of romanticized notion about Mr. Carrasco. The other thing that I wanted to say, and this may or may not be on point, that same West Side produced Henry Cisneros, and I think it's all about choice.
All right, Bill, thank you for the call. So the Tejas Motel, that's where the shootout was, that's on Roosevelt,
yeah.
Still there.
It's still there, and it's still up and running. And right, yeah, that was the site of that, you know, infamous shootout when they finally took him into custody. You know, the caller raises an interesting point also about just, you know, the contradictions in the barrio, right? You know, Henry Cisneros and other folks, you know, the Castro twins, you know, they're all products of the West Side, different parts of the West Side, right? Some deep West Side, some Northwest, you know, area by Jefferson and so on. But right, the barrio has so many, you know, contradictions. It produces, you know, great figures. I guess it's one of the threads that runs through the book. You know, one of the underlying themes is like, you know, talking about human capital, right? You know, and social capital. You know, do gang folks, you know, have worth and value and potential, and do they have connections to conventional people? And of course, it's just it's a mixed bag. You know, it's all that stuff.
How do the cops? How do the gangs work with Cops Metro Alliance to try to bring some reforms and needed services to the West Side?
I would say, you know, former, you know, gang members, you know, that went through the Chicano movement and are enlightened and you know, have some appreciation for the work that they're doing. I mean, of course, they can become vital players in that sort of neighborhood association as well. But I wouldn't say it's typical, you know.
Okay. But that was part of the model, was to tap into existing social networks, the parishes, and gain some local credibility and getting people to become politically active, vote for city council people who will bring services to that area. And the gangs were part of that.
Right. Yeah. Right. The activists, you know, recognize the untapped potential there, you know, that the gangs had with potential voters and just, you know, warm bodies for events, you know, to come and, you know, make a big splash and stuff with demonstrations and things. And that's one thing gang members are pretty good at, is being rowdy, right?
Right. And also pay them the respect that they needed. This is your neighborhood, and we're going to come to you and tell you what we're doing and get your and make sure that you're cool with it.
Exactly. You appeal to that, you know, sense of barrio, you know, and barrio pride and stuff, right?
All right. Jane. Hey, Jane, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Jane.
Did you say, well, it's Jean.
Jean, sorry.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, this is Jean Hennig, and I've lived here for since 2010, and I'm 80. I'll be 80 in August. I want to give this viewpoint from a new arrival, but you guys sound like you're talking about Superman when you talk about this guy. You're giving him all of this, wow, he was really something. And when you talk about the politicians, you're going like muted. You might not realize you're doing it, but you are. We don't need any more glorification of this person. We need glorification of the other people you just mentioned, the Castro twins and Cisneros and the other people. My grandson-in-law, I'll say it eventually, is in prison right now because he grew up here in San Antonio. He's Anglo. He's best friends with everybody. But he started selling drugs 5 or 6 years ago, using and selling. He's in prison. His daughter's life is ruined. You guys need to give a little bit of boost on the this is a bad thing. Yeah.
Okay, Gene.
You want to preserve the history, but you
right.
got to.
Gene, thank you for the call. I got your message. So are we glorifying some of these?
I don't think so. For my part, what's useful to me about the Carrasco story is that it's an analytical, it helps to explain what we have today, right? A lot of people wonder, how did this, Mexican mafia or Texas syndicate or, some of our more, notorious prison gangs come about, right? They've had them in California for, way longer than we've had them here in Texas, right? And they came from somewhere. They were influenced by something. So she's exactly right. They did, I think these guys, took their cue from Carrasco. I think they saw that, he was nearly invincible, right? And it led to something, pretty disastrous. I mean, we all know how the prison gangs operate, with impunity. And that's definitely not a good thing for society, but it is a systematic way that the barrio organizes itself, right? I mean, when people are not making ends meet, they're going to turn to illegitimate means to, get what they need to get, right? And that's one way that society has sort of created these types of figures and these types of organizations.
Right, and if I glorified Fred Gomez Carrasco, I don't mean to do so. I know he was a ruthless killer, and he moved drugs through San Antonio, and he was engaged in prostitution and other terrible activities. He was a criminal. And then he broke out of prison and killed people in that manner as well. But he's a figure in San Antonio, a historic figure in San Antonio that's not really told in our history books. He's just told in ice houses of San Antonio over the Domino's table as people are swapping stories. And just wanted to acknowledge that that happened, right, in our mainstream airwaves here and give that some validation in that area. And this is I want to talk, of Barrio Gangs of San Antonio, 1915 to 2015 is the name of the book. Michael Tapia is the author, professor of criminal justice at New Mexico State University. Thank you so much for joining us. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio.